You're listening to Dig Deep on KEXE, KBXE. We are continuing our conversation with Aaron Brown. You know him from Minnesota Brown. He's our liberal commentator. Chuck Marone, you know him from Strong Towns. He is our conservative commentator. And we're going to talk now more about how parties... How did you put this?
Well, I remember as a kid, I'd like to talk about how they actually go up picking their candidates.
Yeah.
Because they are different, the Republicans and Democrats.
Okay. They've become
in subtle ways. Yeah,
they've become different.
I remember when I was a kid, my grandmother liked Pat Robertson, who ran as a Republican, and also liked Jesse Jackson, who, you know, the only two things that I think that they had in common is they both were like fiery speakers.
Yeah, they're right? both ministers. That's
they're both ministers, it. Right. Yeah. The interesting thing is that the Republican Party found a way to accommodate the Pat Robertson voter, the person who was motivated by the issues that Pat Robertson would have brought in, without Pat Robertson. They didn't really want that to be the standard bearer. You got, I think in that election, it was George Bush, the first George Bush.
Yeah, that's right.
That won. That was in 88. On the other side, the Democratic side, that was when you got
Michael Dukakis. Yeah.
But you almost got Jesse Jackson. You came very, very close to getting Jesse Jackson in 1988. And there were a lot of Democrats at the time who thought that that would have been an absolute disaster. A disaster electorally, which it's hard to, you know, Dukakis didn't exactly do great.
Yeah, maybe Jackson would have done worse than Dukakis, but so what? It was pretty bad
anyway.
Lost,
yeah, right? It was pretty bad anyway.
Yeah.
But the idea was that Jesse Jackson's brand of Democratic populism was just a step too far. It was a step too far of turning things over to the masses, in a sense. And the Democratic Party has always been... correct me if you disagree with this, but it's been a little more open in terms of their process. Like, we're a big tent. Let's get all the factions in.
Well, historically, that's tricky. It's open in that it's always presented itself as the populist party or believes itself to be that. And so guys walking in off the street, that's what they want. Make sure everyone gets their say, that sort of thing.
But the idea of Jesse Jackson as a populist was very consistent with the rhetoric in the 80s of the Democratic Party. But the reality is that that's not what the people running the party wanted to see. And so what was put in place, and this really reared its ugly head in the last election with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, the superdelegate process. The idea was to have a stabilizing force within the party that would basically be, in kind of the history of the U.S. Constitution, this kind of pushback on the fiery populism. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we're still going to have the fiery populace. Jesse Jackson is welcome. Bernie Sanders is welcome. But we're going to have this kind of countervailing force so that we don't become the party of crazy. We don't just embrace the next hot thing and have that take over and then lose subsequent elections.
And it became something that was also designed to prevent hung conventions.
Sure.
And embarrassing situations where maybe for days on end you don't have a nominee. Because maybe, three candidates or four are pretty close. No one's near a majority. And what do you do just to end this and everybody go home and we can vote for a nominee? Well, if there's, 600 to 800 delegates who are not elected, they're not bound to any campaign or candidate because they weren't elected as a delegate for that candidate, they could band together and say, Smith or Jones or whoever, let's just end this. They have the most votes. Let's just stop it. It was a safety valve. And the problem with it is that over time, and certainly in the last couple of cycles, we've seen reference to the use of the word superdelegate gets to sound kind of elitist and haughty. You know, you may be a delegate, but allow me to introduce myself.
You're a super.
I am a superdelegate, which is to say more important than you. That's not the way it was designed, but it was just a safety valve, and they just called them that because they were super elected. They were not elected. They were, because of the nature of them being a member of Congress or a state party chair who was elected by the state party or whoever qualified to be a superdelegate by the rules. And we had them at the state level too, legislators and things like that. They were superdelegates at the state convention. Okay, fine. The problem is that the perception is that, especially in these earlier cycles, when the superdelegates are out there in the world, a member of Congress or whoever, in Minnesota, Keith Ellison or Rick Nolan, or when Rick Nolan was in office, or Betty McCollum, you know, members of Congress, they then can say, you know what, I endorse so-and-so, whoever that is. And as a result, that candidate gets to mark plus one in the nomination fight. They say, I have a delegate who's going to cast their ballot for me on the first ballot, and therefore I am 0.12% closer to getting the nomination.
But before the Iowa caucuses were ever held, Hillary Clinton had hundreds of superdelegates.
Correct.
And so you're basically starting, you know, if the race is to get to 3,000 or whatever it is, she was already starting on the 800 line.
Yeah, you get a little, it's a head start.
Right.
Which is not really what it was meant to do. It was meant to be at the end. You know, when at the end, if Hillary and Sanders are deadlocked and one of them just can't win the nomination, you know, these superdelegates who are not committed could say, you know what, in the interest of the party, we could do this. Go with whoever was getting first place or whoever was the best candidate for the party based on some ideal of some sort. Well, that's not what's happening. And so now superdelegates have become vilified. You know, you saw what happened. Bernie Sanders felt that it was unfair that the superdelegates could vote for Hillary Clinton and not him. Of course, my response to that is, well, this is true of any human being. In the casting of a ballot, one may cast their ballot for anybody they wish, and if they wish to support the established longtime Democrat over the independent Democratic Socialist, that's a political decision that they could make. That's how life happens. Well, that's not, of course, how Sanders played it. He played it as the insiders, and I get it. If you're a political candidate, why you'd play it that way? They're out to get me. Not just before the nomination, but after the nomination, got to be a rallying call, and we saw all of these people,
particularly after November,
when
Hillary Clinton lost. There was a lot of going back saying, Bernie Sanders would have won. You stole this election.
Sure.
We screwed this up.
Yeah.
The party needs a reform.
You even found, though, some people who either voted for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, or who didn't vote or voted for Trump, actually.
There were quite a few Bernie for Trump voters.
Yeah, and they were just disaffected by this whole thing. I think it was a little muted, the previous contested nomination in 2008, because both Obama and Clinton had a lot of superdelegate support. I think Obama got more in the end, but he was winning the election, and then, so that's how that happened. In 2016, it was very pronounced. Hillary Clinton had a significant majority of the superdelegates, and Sanders did not. So Republicans don't really have as much of this. I think they have a small number of
superdelegates. The Republican system, I mean, the other thing that is interesting about the Democratic system, and there's been some reform on this, and all I know is that the reform is de-emphasizing superdelegates. I really don't know structurally how it's going to work out. I guess we'll find out. But the other thing that's unique about the Democratic side is that you get proportional delegates.
Proportional. And that's actually why you need superdelegates, because with proportional primaries, in other words, if Minnesota has 50 delegates at stake, it's not that, but let's say there's 50, and candidates A, B, and C are the main contenders, and they finish 1, 2, 3, A gets 40%, B gets 25%, and C gets 30% or whatever. It's like 40, 35, 25, let's say that. You have to do the math. 40% of the 50, that's 20 delegates for the winner. The loser, the second place, would get like 18, you know, and so on. And then you add up as the states go along. Well, that's lovely. The winner is still the winner. But on the other hand, as you're accumulating delegates, wow, it's like only 20, 30, 40 delegates after a few states like that, separating the person who maybe has won all the primaries and the person who's gotten second.
Think of it this way.
Yeah.
If you have 10 viable candidates and they all split equally, you'll get to the convention and they'll all have 10% of the vote. Well, who would you pick then?
Yeah.
You don't even have someone who's gotten over 50% of the delegates.
Now, different states do it differently, of course, in the Democratic system. Right. And so sometimes there is a winner-take-all kitty in the middle that you get, plus the proportional, and some states are purely proportional, and then a handful are winner-take-all. And in the Republican primary, the big difference is that most of them are winner-take-all.
The Republican system is set up to create basically like a knockout scenario. So Republicans want to fall in line quicker. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the Republican side is that if we can pick a winner as quickly and decisively as we can, that person can stop attacking their fellow Republicans. They can rally around one candidate. We can start fundraising for the general election. And again, if you go back to this military metaphor, if you've got to fight a big battle on November whatever, and you start backing up the date, you want to stop firing at each other behind the lines as quickly as possible and start building up your forces to that day. So the Republicans are set up, and you can see this in the results. George Bush, Bob Dole, George W. Bush, John McCain,
Mitt Romney.
They were the front runners. The Republicans tend to pick like the front runner.
And the front runner is often the one who the old saying is it's their turn.
It's their turn. You know?
And usually it's the candidate either who is the candidate of the moment, like George W. Bush was. He kind of had the heredity of the whole thing. But like John McCain, he had finished second to Bush.
Right.
So let's give it to McCain.
Bob Dole finished, didn't he finish second?
Yeah, he finished second to Bush.
To George Bush, the first.
Right. Way back when, way back in 80 or...
88, I think it was.
Yeah, 88, when Bush got elected.
So you look at this, and the idea is, let's get him in, let's have a contest. I mean, I remember when Pat Buchanan ran an insurgency against George Bush.
In 92.
In 92, it was crazy. But, you know, that was over after South Carolina, too.
Yeah.
And then it was
like... Didn't he win New Hampshire, and that was the excitement?
He won New Hampshire, and it seemed like, you know, would we get a Lyndon Johnson moment where he drops out and all that? And no, and then it was over.
Yeah.
And then you moved on. The Democratic process, and I think it's probably going to be even more so this time around because of the de-emphasis of delegates, becomes this more drawn out, contentious, difficult, and let's put a positive spin on it, meaningful and engaging.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Minnesota, actually, the vote will matter.
Super Tuesday primaries are all going to count. They're all going to mean something.
Right. And on the Republican side, Super Tuesdays have never... I mean, my vote in Minnesota has never counted in the Republican primary. Never. For president. It's never mattered because the decisions made by then are so close to being made that it's like whatever.
Right. Being a political person, I have always taken interest in the presidential race. I mean, my first awareness of politics was in 1980. Well, it was 84. I remember watching Mondale as a little kid, but I remember, I think it was 92 when Bill Clinton got nominated. I was 11 or I would have been 11 when this was going on. And I had a little notebook and I watched one of these very, very early presidential debates. And I remember Tom Harkin was running. I think Jesse Jackson was running again and some others.
Paul Tsongas.
Cuomo was going to maybe run. That was like a big thing. Maybe Mario Cuomo was going to run. Anyway, I had my notebook and I was writing down the things they were saying. And and of course, I couldn't have voted anyway. I was a kid. But by the time Minnesota got to vote in the caucuses during the election, of course, it was starting to the drumbeat toward Clinton had already started. You know, that was nearly decided. You know, I've gotten involved in a lot of campaigns. I remember Howard Dean. He didn't make it to Minnesota. I remember I was a big Bill Bradley guy back when Gore Bradley in 2000. I was like, Bill Bradley. Well, he was smoked by the time. But it happens less in the Democratic Party than it does in the Republican because of that knockout system. Republicans, though, got a little surprised. Usually the knockout is designed to benefit their establishment candidate.
That's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why you're not going to see this time much of a challenge, because it is wired for the establishment candidate, which now is Donald Trump.
Right.
But if you get the upstart that can come in like he did 4 years ago, throw some sucker punches at people and get himself in a position, he can close the deal really quick.
Well, and if you look back at 2016 in the early Republican primary, who was the front runner? Kinda Jeb Bush? Kinda? But I don't know many Republicans that were super
enthusiastic. Marco Rubio?
Rubio had a flash, but it wasn't super clear.
It wasn't.
You know, it wasn't super clear who the establishment person was.
After 8 years of Barack Obama, there was no kind of standard bearer anointed. Jeb Bush was the closest, and that was really the hereditary thing.
And it almost worked against him.
And it worked against him ultimately, because who wanted to see another
third
Clinton Bush campaign?
Right. Right. And to the idea of having a third member of one family within a 40-year period be president of the United States, that wasn't sitting well.
Right.
And Rubio had a flash as the front runner. He won Minnesota, but but nobody, I don't think he was ever a clear-cut front runner. And then there were a lot of other candidates. Like just like in the Democratic primary this time, there were many, many candidates who everybody kind of understood weren't going to be the nominee, but they had their own reason for being involved in the campaign. And maybe we want to talk about this later. Like, there's a reason why 20 candidates are running, and probably 15 of them know damn well they're not going to win the nomination.
Right.
There's benefits for them and their policy issues sometimes, or their own careers for others, you know, their own ability to sell books and get speaking
engagements. Or someday become vice president.
Or someday become vice president. Or
I've heard Amy Klobuchar is hoping for Supreme Court someday. Is what
sure,
she's
yeah.
Now.
Klobuchar would be a very viable Supreme Court candidate, a attorney general candidate,
I think
or a vice
at,
president
candidate. You look at Joe Biden, and Joe Biden, this is his third time running for president or
yeah,
fourth time?
Third time.
I don't think he ever thought he'd be, you know, the first two times he was not going to be president.
Yeah.
I don't think he had any, you know, illusions that he would.
He botched the first run and no one was going to use him for anything.
Right.
And then the second time when he was running in 08, there was nobody thought Biden was going to be the nominee.
He was running for vice president.
And he got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Amy Klobuchar is kind of that similar ilk.
Right.
Minnesota has a long, especially the Minnesota Democratic Party has a long history of cultivating
great
vice presidents. Oh, we are so good at that. And she actually would fit in with anybody. She could go in with Biden and be a gender balance for a ticket and a little bit younger, kind of a, you know, you could see a little bit of a buddy situation there where they would be a fun pair to have on your TV screens. And then if it's Warren or Sanders, Klobuchar could be a tempering kind of person to say, okay, we still have Midwestern, moderate values in this party. And so, you know, Klobuchar could serve either or. And that's what makes her the ideal vice presidential
right.
candidate.
But she's got to stay viable.
But she's got to convey the notion she could win to have that leverage.